You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lopate today. The novelist Joshua Henkin's latest novel, The World Without You, tells the story of the reverberations in a family after the youngest son, a journalist, is murdered on assignment in Iraq. When Leo's parents and three sisters gather at their summer home to hold a memorial for him, sibling rivalries and marital feuds erupt. While these are common topics in novels about families, they are only part of this story. The book is published by Pantheon Books, and I'm pleased it has brought Joshua Henkin to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Thank you, Julie. I'm really happy to be here.
Now, this book takes place not on a day that we all can remember because it's in the recent past, which is July 4th. The whole family has gathered on July 4th. Was there a reason you chose Independence Day as a day for this family to gather?
I think so. I mean, the book takes place up in the Berkshires and Lenox in the family's country house, and they always spend July 4th there. They spend actually much of the summer there. But because the book takes place during the Bush era, and it's about a guy who was killed, a journalist killed in the Iraq War, I think I was interested in contrast in general. You know, what is it like to be in the Berkshires where everyone is celebrating things and where everything seems perfect, and to be mourning for your son who was a journalist killed in Iraq? What's it like to be mourning on July 4th when everyone else is celebrating and celebrating a country about which at least some of the characters are ambivalent?
And it's interesting, you know, July 4th began in a year where there was a lot of loss and a lot of death because there was another war going on. And it's funny, we sometimes forget that that's the origin of this particular holiday.
I think that's true. I mean, I think a lot of celebrations are there in part to cover up what brought about the celebration, which isn't always so pretty.
Or to, as these characters do, deal with the grief that goes along with the freedom. In this family, as you say, there are real differences of opinion. This young man, who was also a husband and a father, is a son and a brother, and his death has triggered politicization of some of the family members in ways that they might not have expected. Can you talk about that?
Sure. You know, it's a family that hails from all over the world right now. I mean, they were born and grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, but there are three surviving sisters who are ages 39, 38, and 37. One lives in Brooklyn in Park Slope with her husband. She's a former gifted cellist who's given up the cello and is now struggling with infertility. There's another sister who lives in Washington, D.C. Then there's a youngest sister who has become an Orthodox Jew and lives in Jerusalem with her husband and her four sons. And the widow is an anthropology graduate student at Berkeley. And so they're all coming from all four corners of the earth. But yes, I mean, the politics of the family are quite different depending on whom you talk to. Marilyn, the mother, as part of her grief, has taken to the nation's op-ed pages, and she has written 24 op-eds over the course of the last year, and she's kind of become a spokesperson for and a mascot of the left. And she and the youngest daughter, I'm sorry, she and the middle daughter, Lily, have often done political things together. They went down to Florida to protest the Bush v. Gore case. They campaigned for Kerry together. On the other hand, Noelle, who's living in Jerusalem with her husband and four sons, believes that Bush is Israel's greatest friend, and she voted for Bush absentee twice. She voted for him even after Leo died, and so her sister Lily thinks that she kind of killed her own brother. So there's certainly a lot of political sparks that fly over the course of the book.
The title is The World Without You, which in a sense is addressed to the one who is absent. And it does feel like even though there are all these dramas taking place, in a sense they are all constellations around this black hole of the loss of this brother.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to give my agent credit here because she's the one who came up with the title.
Titles are hard.
They are very hard, and I love the title, so I'm very grateful to her. But I think this sort of this sense of the lurking absence is very important in the book because, you know, the novel takes place over the course of 3 days. And Leo is both the central character, but he's also dead. And, you know, we never see him in the here and now. And so I think a lot of the book is in part about the different memories that people have of him and the conflicting memories that people have of him. You know, when someone dies, people tend to remember them differently from how they actually were.
And it's also about how families are little universes of their own, and without the gravitational pull of one of those planets, everything shifts, all of the relationships, not just the ones with the person who died.
Absolutely. I think that that's really true. I think the loss makes a big difference. I also think, you know, they're coming back to their summer home in the Berkshires where they've been for 40 years. And, I mean, they're all adults and they have lives of their own, but there's something about coming back to the home in which you lived as a child that does things to you. I mean, my mother lives in the apartment in Morningside Heights in which my brothers and I grew up. And as soon as I set foot across the threshold, I become a teenager at best. So I think, you know, I think going home does that. And also there's something about a country house. I mean, I don't have a country house, but I know people who do, and I have a sense of what it's like in the Berkshires because I visited. And there's something about being in the, you know, if you return home to Manhattan, you can go out to a bar, you can go take the subway somewhere, but there's something claustrophobic about being in a country house where there's nowhere to go after 10 o'clock at night. And I think that helps a novel because it allows the characters to butt heads.
Where did the idea for this novel come from for you?
Yeah. I had a cousin who died of Hodgkin's disease when he was in his late 20s, and I was only a toddler at the time. So I didn't really know him. But my father's side of the family has a reunion every year, and a lot of us don't see each other except for at that reunion. So at the beginning of the reunion, we catch each other up on what we've been up to. And once when I was in my early 30s, my aunt, my cousin's mother, got up and said, "I have two sons." And we were quite struck by her saying that because she'd once had two sons, but her older son had died 30 years earlier at that point. And she wasn't delusional. She understood that her son had died. But this was her way of saying that that was the singular seminal event in her life. And meanwhile, my cousin's wife eventually moved on. She got remarried. She had a child. I mean, it really got me thinking about the difference between losing a partner or a spouse on one hand and losing a child on the other. That, you know, there are always exceptions. But I think in general, if you lose a partner or a spouse when you're relatively young, as hard as that is, you eventually pick up the pieces and move on. Whereas for a parent, I think it's much harder. So the original inspiration for the book was that tension between mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. And then as I started to write, I mean, the book never ends up being what you think it's about. I mean, I think it's okay for a novelist to think he knows where he's going, but you better be wrong. Because I think if you're right, you get what a friend of mine calls Lipton cup of story, where you're injecting your characters into a preordained plot. So I started to write about these sisters, and the book became much more complicated. But at least initially, it was that tension between mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. And I guess the other thing I'd say is that, you know, even though my cousin was the inspiration for the book, I didn't really know my cousin because I was only a toddler when he died. But my father was dying as I was writing this book. He was quite elderly, and he had dementia toward the end of his life. And I obviously, you know, knew him and loved him. And so I think at a certain point, I was aware that he would not be alive when the book was done. And so even though the book is not about the death of an elderly person, I think I was channeling that kind of impending grief. Because I think all novels have to be emotionally autobiographical in some way. You know, the writer Ron Carlson once said, "I write from personal experiences, whether or not I had them." And I think that's how I feel about fiction writing.
I'm speaking with the novelist Joshua Henkin. His book is The World Without You from Pantheon Books. You mentioned a moment ago that you start out writing a novel, and then it sounds like the characters themselves start doing things you had not intended them to do. How do you create space within your writing for that to happen rather than ending up with, this is what I've decided to do and here's what I'm going to do?
Yeah, that's a great question, Julie, and it's something I struggle with all the time. You know, I direct the Fiction MFA program at Brooklyn College. This is something we talk about with our students. And I think a writer needs to find a balance between knowing too much, and then you get, as I said before, a Lipton cup of story, or knowing too little, and then you can end up just writing a lot of pretty sentences that are not going in any particular direction. So I often think about the Passover Seder. In the Passover Seder, you ask, you know, why is this night different from all other nights? And that is the mother of all Passover questions, and I think of it as the mother of all fiction questions, is that you're writing about a series of events and why today, what's important about today. And so I think in terms of situations where big things can happen, even though you don't know what they're going to be. So I like to set my stories and my novels at, you know, memorials, reunions, graduations, Thanksgiving meals, you know, situations where people can come into conflict with each other. And I think if you do that, you can get a kind of balance. You know, I used to teach at Sarah Lawrence, and often with my undergrads, I found that they either were writing simply about themselves, or they're writing simply things they didn't know. You know, they were writing simply what they knew, which was, you know, a transcript of the frat party, or simply what they didn't know, which was Martians. And I always think that you should write what you know about what you don't know, or what you don't know about what you know, which is another way of saying that, you know, put yourself in a situation that's unfamiliar to you, or put someone else in a situation that's familiar to you. And I think you're always trying to negotiate the distance between too close and too far.
And it also sounds like put your characters in a situation where they're going to be collisions, where they're going to rub up against each other, because that will generate a story.
Absolutely. I mean, I tell my graduate students, and I'm a big believer that if you tell your graduate students something, you have to do it yourself, because you have to walk the walk. You can't just talk the talk. But I often see that a lot of very, very talented young writers struggle with the following. I mean, they write really well. They have an exquisite sense of character, but they have trouble telling a story because their characters are just watching. And I think, you know, writers in particular are big watchers. And then beyond that, I think we're conflict averse in real life. You know, when I get on the subway in New York, my goal is to get to my destination and not to get into conflict with one of my fellow writers. And I think writers have to teach themselves that conflict aversion is not a good thing in fiction. So what I tell my students is, imagine your character sits down on a bus and a stranger sits down next to him or her and puts his or her hand on their thigh. What do you do? You can scream, you can get up, you can put your hand back on their thigh. You can do nothing, I suppose, but in that case, doing nothing is doing something. So what I'm trying to tell my students and what I tell myself is that we need characters to be metaphorically putting their hands on each other's thighs. And that's how you get the kind of conflict that you're talking about, Julie.
What is it like for you? It sounds like you have worked very hard to think about work that often for many people comes unselfconsciously. Although as a writer, I think you're always self-conscious, but you are a writer and a teacher of writing. How does that affect your own work as a novelist?
Yeah, teaching has been very central for my writing. And I guess, I mean, in some ways I almost start out as a teacher, by which I mean my route to becoming a writer was complicated and circuitous. I always wanted to be a fiction writer, but then I also always wanted to be a basketball player. And at some point, you realize you're neither tall enough nor good enough. And that was kind of how I felt about fiction writing, that I wasn't tall enough or good enough. And I came from this weird family in that my father was a very successful academic. He taught at Columbia Law School for many years. And so I was probably the one person in the country who thought the safe, conservative route would be to get a PhD in the humanities. So that was my plan. But when I graduated from college, I decided to take what I thought would be a year off. And I moved out to Berkeley. And I was determined to move out to Berkeley because I had a romanticized idea of Berkeley. I was born in 1964. And one of my earliest memories is in 1968, my mother taking me up to the Greenhouse Nursery School near College Walk at Columbia. And we were turned back at the gates by the protesters. So that was my version of a snow day. And I think I always had this romanticized version of Columbia in the 60s. And I kind of thought that if Columbia was good, Berkeley was even better. And so I moved out to Berkeley. But even in Berkeley, when you're 23 years old, you need to find a job. And so I found a job at a magazine. And one of my jobs at the magazine was to be the first reader of fiction manuscripts. And I saw how many terrible submissions there were.
There were other people who were not short enough, who were short, yeah,
exactly,
and not good enough.
Yeah. And I felt oddly inspired. I thought if other people were willing to try and risk failure, I should be willing to try and risk failure too. And then I started to write. But all this is by way of saying that quite early on, I was able to figure out what wasn't working in someone else's story. But it took me much longer to learn how to do it myself. So I had to teach myself to become a more intuitive writer. And I do have a lot of writer friends who wouldn't begin to know how to teach just because they do things so intuitively. Whereas I came from the other direction. I now can do things intuitively, but I had to teach myself to do that. And, you know, teaching students helps me in that regard. And also, I'm a relatively social person. And writing is very isolating.
It
I mean,
is.
We spend all this time with our characters. And so the chance to be with other people who are passionate about their work. So for me, the two are very intimately tied. And I feel like I learn things from my students all the time.
Well, it sounds like you have the gift of being able to talk about how to do this thing that many people can't talk about, and also the chance to do it yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I do enjoy that. And I think it allows me to move forward with my own work when I see my students struggling with the same things that I'm struggling with.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Joshua Henkin about his work as a teacher and about his novel, The World Without You. It's published by Pantheon. Joshua, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here, Julie.